So we come to Genesis chapters 34, 35, and 36 this morning. We last left Jacob reuniting with his brother Esau after a number of years, after Jacob had been living north up in the land of Paddan Aram, where his father and mother had sent him to go find a wife, and he did. He found two wives, actually, and he built his household over some number of years there, and we read about his journey then leaving Paddan Aram and heading back down into the land of Canaan. And so the first question I sent out was about the circumstances around, you know, what led Jacob to being in the city of Shechem there at the end of chapter 33. So I thought it might be useful to actually kind of rewind a little bit back through the life of Jacob, not too much, but if we go back to chapter 28, which is where God first appears to Jacob. Jacob is in Bethel, which isn't named Bethel at that point in time. But in verses 14 and 15, we have the record of God speaking to Jacob and making certain promises to Jacob, and tells him in verse 15 that he would bring him back to this land. So the land where Jacob had lived, and specifically at that point in time, he's in Bethel. So then if we flip a little bit further forward, chapter 31. Chapter 31 is where Jacob is leaving Laban and leaving Paddan Aram. And God speaks to him there again. Chapter 31 and verse 3, the Lord says to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." And so, you know, if we think back to where Isaac and Rebekah lived and, you know, where Jacob was born, and as far as we know where Isaac really lived and spent most of his time, it was in that southern section of Canaan, specifically Beersheba, where Isaac had dug a well and had really established his home there in Beersheba. So then, you know, God tells Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives." So that would seem to indicate, the, you know, Beersheba, where his relatives are living. And verse 13, he says again, God says again to Jacob, he says, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth." And if we do look back to chapter 26, where Jacob was born, it seems like Isaac and Rebekah were living in Beersheba at the time that Jacob was born. So, you know, that it seems to indicate that God is telling Jacob, go back down to Beersheba. Chapter 32, we see in verse 9, and this is now before Jacob meets up with Esau, God says again to Jacob, "Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you." So it seems like God's telling Jacob, you know, all the way from Paddan Aram, you know, go back to the land of your relatives, which would seem to be, you know, into the land where you were born, would seem to be Beersheba. So then we get into chapter 33, and it's interesting the dialogue that occurs between Esau and Jacob. So in verse 12 of chapter 33, Esau says, "Let's take our journey, and I'll go before you." So this is after Jacob and Esau, you know, have had their joyous reunion. Jacob says, "I'll go before you." In verse 14, Jacob tells Esau, "No, you go ahead, and I'll come to you at Seir." So that's where Esau was living. Seir is in that southern section of Canaan on the east side of the Dead Sea. And then verse 16 of chapter 33. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, which was this, you know, it was the mountainous region east of the Dead Sea where Esau settled and ultimately where the nation of Edom inhabited. But verse 17 is interesting of chapter 33. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock, and therefore the place is named Succoth. And then verse 18, now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he camped in the city there. So I'm not sure it was really a part of God's plan for Jacob to settle in Shechem. Yeah, it was in the land of Canaan, but it doesn't seem to be where his relatives were living at the time. It wasn't the land of his birth. And so Jacob, and we're not really told a whole lot about that, but it's just interesting that Jacob, he tells Esau, yeah, you go on to Seir and I'll meet you there. He's told all along the way by God to go back to the land of your relatives, to the land of your birth. But then he seems to take this detour or diversion, and he ends up in the city of Shechem. You know, perhaps this was another point of deceit. You know, he tells Esau one thing, I'll meet you in Seir, but then he actually ends up in Shechem. We just don't really know for sure. But what we do know is Jacob ends up in Shechem, and then we have all of the, you know, the nastiness that happens in chapter 34 that we come to next. And, you know, perhaps that was all a result of Jacob making this decision for him and his household to settle in Shechem, whereas it seems like, you know, he was being told maybe to go to a different place further south into Canaan. Just kind of interesting when you kind of read through all of that and you see where Jacob lands and then, you know, what ensues in chapter 34. And maybe that's even, you know, why we're told that he ended up in Shechem. Maybe that's why we're told all this that happened in chapter 34 was because he had ended up in Shechem. I don't know. Any other thoughts about that? Anybody else look at that, spend any time thinking about that this week? If not, that's okay. It's we're not really told a whole lot of information about that, but it's just kind of interesting to see how all that played out. So we get into chapter 34, and Jacob's daughter, Dinah, who is the daughter of Jacob and Leah, she goes to visit these the daughters of the Hivites who are living in this land where Jacob and his household now are. And, you know, we know the story. Shechem, who is Hamor's son, you know, he's attracted to Dinah. He essentially rapes Dinah. And we see what ensues there. So let's think a little bit about these Hivites. Like, who were these people that Jacob's household are now living close to? If we go back to the 10th chapter of Genesis, we see I think the first mention of the Hivites. So chapter 10 takes us back to the descendants of Noah, his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And if we look in verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. And then we drop down to verse 15, Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and so forth, and these other families of the Canaanites. So that's where these Hivites have come from. They were sons of Canaan, so obviously they were Canaanites, or living in Canaan, and sons of Ham, son of Noah. So we're also told a little bit further down, verse 19 there in chapter 10, that the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the north all the way down into, you know, Gerar in the south, which we've encountered in our studies of Abraham and Isaac, as far as Gaza, and then crossing as far as Sodom and Gomorrah to the east. So pretty much in that entire land there of Canaan. So it's a little bit about, you know, who these Hivites were living in the land of Canaan, specifically in this land of Shechem, where Jacob now is living. And, you know, in thinking about what happens in chapter 34, and thinking about Noah's curse on Canaan and all of Canaan's sons, we see that maybe chapter 34 is the beginning of kind of the subjugation of Canaan's descendants to the descendants of Shem, which would have included Jacob as well as Esau. So chapter 34, we have this account then of Shechem, you know, desiring Dinah, and he's deeply attracted to her. And that was the motivation then for Hamor and Shechem to come and approach Jacob. So Shechem in verse 4 tells his father Hamor to get Dinah for him as a wife. You know, he doesn't ask his father, he tells his father, go get her for me as a wife. And it's interesting that at least in the New American Standard says, you know, get me for a wife. So we don't know if Shechem already had wives, took other wives, we don't know, but at least we know that he wanted Dinah, he wanted her as a wife. So Hamor has this conversation with Jacob. Hamor goes, sees Jacob, and he explains in verse 8 that the soul of his son Shechem longs for his daughter. And Hamor even tries to sweeten the deal a little bit. He says, you know, give us your daughters and we'll give you ours, intermarry with us. The land will be open before you, and live and trade in it and acquire property in it. So they're really trying, you know, Hamor and Shechem are really trying to kind of, you know, embrace Jacob's household, the Israelites. And Shechem kind of jumps into this conversation, verses 11 and 12, and he adds, you know, I'll give you whatever you want, name your price. And so we'll come back to that in a moment. So that's Hamor and Shechem's proposal to Jacob in order to obtain Dinah as a wife for Hamor's son Shechem. But there was a condition. And so what was the condition that Jacob's sons placed on Hamor and Shechem in order to accept this proposal?
Well, they didn't want an uncircumcised man to be married to their sister. So
right.
He suggested that they all get circumcised.
Right. Yeah. Maybe even more than a suggestion. Verse 14, you know, the Jacob's sons, we're not told which sons, but Jacob's sons speak up and say, well, we can't do this. We can't give our sister to one who's uncircumcised. You know, that would be a disgrace. So the condition, you know, it wasn't just for Shechem or Shechem and Hamor to become circumcised, but it's for all of the males of their people to become circumcised. And then it's interesting that to Hamor and Shechem, you know, they said, okay, that seems reasonable. That seems reasonable to them at that time. In fact, in verse 19, we're told that Shechem didn't delay because he was so delighted with Dinah, and he was, you know, so intent on obtaining her as a wife. So they go ahead and, you know, they pursue this. Now, of course, Hamor and Shechem have the task before them to go back to their town and convince all of the males to become circumcised. First, we're given a little bit of information about Shechem, a little more information. Chapter 34 and verse 19, we see that he was more respected than all the household of his father. And so perhaps that's a little bit of information that kind of helps explains what happens next. And so how is it that Hamor and Shechem are able to persuade the rest of their people, their males, to go through with circumcision?
And Greg, it looks like there's a mention that they told the people that, hey, they want to live in peace with us. So that would have been appealing, that they weren't there to take from them, but also that their livestock and all their possessions would be before them as well. And they could share in their success, basically, is the way I read that.
Yeah, that's right. There's no mention of that when Hamor and Shechem were talking to Jacob and his sons, although there was that you know, statement about, you know, the land will be open for you, you know, live in it, trade in it, acquire property in it, and so forth. But when Hamor and Shechem go talk to, you know, their people, they kind of turn that around a little bit and they say, hey, you know, these people are going to come live with us. You know, they'll give us their daughters and eventually want all their livestock and their property be ours. So, you know, maybe there's a little bit of deceit going on there as well. Deceit sort of mashed by the deceit of Jacob's sons. So we see a kind of a pattern of deceit, you know, in all of this, right? We see Jacob as a deceiver. We've seen that before in his life. His sons and household now are exposed perhaps to the deceit of the Hivites and the Shechems. And then his sons too are deceivers, because we know how this is going to end. So, you know, the story, you know, plays out, or the account, that the Hivites agree. You know, it seems to make sense to them. So they, all of the males become circumcised. And 3 days later, while, you know, they're essentially all, you know, recovering and they're in great pain, two sons in particular of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, were told, take their swords into the city, and they slay every male, and they loot the city. You know, and they take their flocks, their herds, their donkeys, all the property that was in the city, all the property that was in the field, all their wealth, all their children, all their wives, and all that was in their houses. So a little bit of irony here, too, and then it's almost as the very thing that Hamor and Shechem were telling their people, that, you know, eventually they're going to be able to acquire this property from the Israelites that's theirs by allowing them in and intermarrying and allowing them into their land. You know, instead, it's kind of the opposite that happens. The Israelites actually end up acquiring all the property of these Hivites and done, you know, essentially in a day. So that happens in chapter 34. And what was Jacob's reaction to all of that? And it's kind of interesting, because even in the dialogue with Hamor and Shechem, we don't really hear anything from Jacob. We don't really hear from Jacob until, you know, this occurs with Simeon and Levi. And then now he speaks up. And what's his reaction to all of this?
You've made me a stink among the nations around us by what you did.
Yeah, right. Right, verse 30 of chapter 34. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. And then Simeon and Levi respond with a rhetorical question that doesn't really get answered about, well, should he treat our sister as a harlot? So Jacob now, you know, despite the promise that God has made him, that God's going to be with him and God's going to bring him back and God's not going to leave him until he completes and executes everything that he had promised to Jacob. Jacob's got, you know, a fair amount of fear now based on this interaction that they've had with these Canaanites already in the land. The Perizzites, as near as I can tell, I think that it's one of the first times we read about them, but the word there means villagers or those who live in villages. And so I don't know that it's necessarily a separate nation per se. It might be describing, well, Canaanites is maybe generally those who live in the land, Perizzites, those who live in the villages within Canaan. At any rate, Jacob is concerned they're all going to gather together against him and his household at this point in time. So that brings us to chapter 35 then. And once again, God, you know, speaks to Jacob. Keep in mind, Jacob's in Shechem, and God speaks to him. And now God's very specific. He says, get up, you know, arise and go to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God. And does Jacob take this seriously? He seems to take it seriously. He certainly obeys, right? He tells his household, put away their foreign gods, purify themselves, change their clothes. And so they give to him all of these foreign gods And, you know, when we think about those foreign gods, like, why would they have had those anyway in the first place? We know that Rachel had taken certain household gods from Laban when Jacob and all of his household and his wives left Paddan Aram and fled from Laban. So we know they had those. It seems like maybe there were more that they had, because it sounds like all of the household give to Jacob all of these foreign gods, or literally what that means is gods of foreigners. You know, they likely would have had servants in this household, servants who were Syrians, not necessarily Hebrews. And so there's this whole collection of people, you know, and his wives anyway, Rachel and Leah, they had grown up, you know, with Laban. Apparently, we don't know exactly what these household gods were, but, you know, they were important enough to Rachel to take them with her when they left. So they do give them all to Jacob. And then what does he do with them once he's got all of these household gods? We're told something very specific that he did, and it's kind of interesting.
He buried them under a tree there in Shechem.
Right. Verse 4 of chapter 35. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem. And we're not told why he did that. You know, we don't read God saying anything, you know, to him about doing this. Jacob certainly says in verse 2, you know, put away these foreign gods. So he gets them all from them. And he hides them, he buries them under this oak tree in Shechem. I can only come up with a couple of reasons why Jacob might have done that. One, maybe he, you know, actually he didn't want anybody in the household to know where they were so that they would never get them again. That's probably the optimistic way of looking at that. More cynically, maybe he intended to go back and get them again and use them again in their household somehow, or allow his people to after they were done doing what they were going to do at Bethel. We certainly know that idolatry was a difficult obstacle to the Israelites, and it seems like as early as this point in history, they, you know, still struggled with serving, you know, solely Jehovah or Jehovah and these other household gods. So we don't really know why, but that's what he does with them. He hides them under this oak tree in Shechem, and then they journey from Shechem to Bethel. And there's an interesting kind of dynamic in the land of Canaan as they're journeying from Shechem to Bethel. And what is that? Verse 5 of chapter 35.
It says, Greg says, the terror of God was upon the cities around them, so that they did not pursue Jacob and his family. So that was God going before them to protect them so they could travel safely.
Right, exactly. So the very, you know, Jacob had this concern about the Canaanites and the Perizzites, you know, gathering against him. But instead, as they're journeying from Bethel from Shechem to Bethel, you know, as God had promised, he's with them, he's protecting them, and some sort of terror comes over all the people in the land of Canaan to basically, you know, let Jacob and his household be, don't pursue them. And so they arrive at Bethel in verse 6. So Jacob came to Luz, which is what it used to be called, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all his people who are with him, and he built an altar there. So God makes, again, certain promises to Jacob now that he has returned to Bethel. And what are these promises that we see God making to or reiterating to Jacob? Starts off again with changing his name, or reiterating that his name is changed. It's no longer Jacob, it shall be Israel. Verses 9 through 12.
He promises him that his descendants will be a nation, and in fact, company of nations or multiple nations will come from him, that he will give him and his descendants this land that he had previously promised to his fathers, Abraham and Isaac.
Right. So very similar promises, you know, promises that we have read of before, with maybe a little more information. So he's told kings shall come forth from you. And he does reference the promises made to his father and grandfather, you know, the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac. And it's interesting the way God says that, that I gave it to Abraham. So it's already been given, even though Abraham and Isaac, you know, didn't necessarily possess the land, but God refers to it as already given to Abraham and Isaac. He will now give it to Jacob and to the descendants after him. And so, you know, similar to what happened the first time Jacob was in Bethel and God spoke to him, Jacob sets up a stone in that place. He pours a drink offering on it. And then they continue to travel from there. It seems they're traveling toward Beersheba to meet up again, be reunited with Isaac and Rebekah. On the way, Jacob's wife, Rachel, dies. She gives birth to their last son, Benjamin, and dies in childbirth. She names Benjamin Ben-Oni, or Oni, son of my sorrow, which is what that means. But Jacob renames him Benjamin, son of my right hand. And we know that later on that Joseph and Benjamin were quite dear to Jacob. So Rachel dies and she's buried, and this is actually near Bethlehem. And so much later in history, Jeremiah alludes to this fact where Rachel had been buried in Bethlehem. So in part of his prophecy in chapter 31 of Jeremiah, he references Rachel and that she's weeping for her children, a reference, you know, explaining, or the imagery there is the Israelites at that point, the nation of Judah in particular, have been taken away to Babylonian captivity. And, you know, the image that Jeremiah uses, there's Rachel who, you know, all of these would have been descendants of, well, not of just Rachel, but maybe figuratively of Rachel. You know, she's buried there, and the idea is she looks around and all of her children have been taken away and they're not there anymore. And then that prophecy, that piece of Jeremiah's prophecy is quoted by Matthew in reference to Herod's slaughter of all the young Hebrew boys 2 years and under that occurred there in Matthew chapter 2. So Rachel, she dies. She's buried in Bethlehem. Interestingly, not in the cave of Machpelah in Mamre that we have read about. And I think that's because Leah was Jacob's first wife. And I think that Leah does actually ultimately end up getting buried in that cave along with Jacob later on. So this section of the text then, chapter 35, it ends with Jacob and Esau reuniting once again at the death of Isaac. And he is buried in that cave at Mamre or Hebron. And so that brings us to the end of Isaac's life and a bit more in the life of Jacob. We're not done with Jacob yet. We'll return to him shortly. But chapter 36 is interesting because we come to really more about Esau and Esau's people. And there's this recounting of the lineage of Esau. And, you know, if you're like me, you kind of read through this, you see all these names and all of this, and you kind of wonder why this is recorded. Why did the Holy Spirit, you know, find it important to include all of this information in chapter 36, particularly even, you know, about the family of Esau? So, you know, Ishmael is mentioned, but he wasn't the son of promise. He wasn't the chosen one. Isaac was, so we have more information about Isaac. And then we know that between Jacob and Esau, Jacob was the chosen one, and the promise was to be conveyed and continued through Jacob and not Esau. Esau was rejected. In fact, we looked at that earlier. So what are your thoughts on perhaps, you know, why do we have all this information then about the descendants of Esau in this part of Genesis, chapter 36? Any thoughts on that? A lot of these names, you know, some of these names we might recognize, but some of them we don't really read much more about throughout the history. I think, you know, one thought might be that if we keep in mind, Moses is writing all of this. He's writing Genesis all the way through Deuteronomy. And he's writing it primarily and initially for the Israelites as they are journeying and as they are about to enter into the land of Canaan. And remember, they've been down in Egypt for 400 years or more. And so they're now coming back into this land of Canaan, and they're about to encounter this nation of Edom. And so that may be a reason why the Holy Spirit saw fit and Moses, you know, recorded all of this information essentially about this nation of Edom that they're about to encounter or maybe already had encountered. We'll look at that in a minute. And just explaining who this nation is, where they came from, and helping the Israelites to see if there's actually a relationship between them, you know, the children of Israel, and this nation of Edom. So if we look at this chapter, verses 6-8 really kind of set up that the nation of Edom descended from Esau and occupied the hill country of Seir, which we've talked about before. We see that in verse 9 there. They occupied the hill country of Seir. And then if we kind of skip to the last part of the chapter, verses 31-39, we have this recounting of descendants of Esau who became chiefs of the Edomites and also those who had become kings of the Edomites. But then we also have this recounting of the descendants of Seir, who was a Horite, who inhabited the land. And, you know, perhaps part of the reason that Moses includes this, and this seems maybe a little strange too, right? Because these aren't even Israel. These people didn't come from Isaac or from Abraham. This is a whole separate group of people, the Horites, but we've got all this information and lineage and genealogy here as well. But there actually is a connection between the Edomites and these Horites because one of Esau's wives was Oholibamah, who was a granddaughter of Seir the Horite. So in giving all of this information, you know, Moses is helping the Israelites understand these people now who are called Edomites and live in this part of Canaan, which is the southeasternmost part of the land, in fact. Yes, they predominantly descended from Esau, but they were also, you know, they're intermarried and interrelated with this other group of people, the Horites, and kind of a little bit about who they were and where they came from and the relationship between them. So I think that helps give some context to chapter 36, helps us to kind of see sort of where it fits into this narrative. Now, with regard to the Edomites themselves, you know, we do read more about them. Particularly, there is something that occurs between the Israelites and the Edomites that's recorded in Numbers chapter 20. And so if you want to just flip over there briefly, Numbers chapter 20, we see this interaction that occurs between the Edomites and the Israelites. As the Israelites are journeying from Egypt, you know, they're passing through the wilderness and they are approaching the land of Canaan. And so in Numbers chapter 20, starting in verse 14, from Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, that we stayed in Egypt a long time, the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel, brought us out from Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left. until we pass through your territory. Now notice verse 18. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. So there's this incident as the Israelites are journeying from Egypt up into Canaan. And this is before the 40 years of wandering. So they've just recently left Egypt and Moses is still leading them and with them. And they come to Edom. And they basically just request, you know, very respectfully, it seems, to just pass through their land, and Edom refuses that. This incident is referenced later, is referenced in Judges, when the judge Jephthah he's encountering the king of Ammon. And not to get into all that dialogue, but Jephthah mentions, hey, this is what happened, and the Israelites and the Edomites, and the Edomites refused the Israelites. And that was a significant incident in the history of the Israelites, and really kind of became a stain on the nation of Edom. So then one other thing too about the Horites, who were a part of the Edomites, is we do read about them back in Genesis chapter 14. And this is all just kind of help us to kind of connect all of this narrative, because it can get a little confusing at times, because there's a lot to it, and a lot of names and places that we may not be familiar with. But in the 14th chapter of Genesis that we studied, a couple of weeks ago, this is where that king from Mesopotamia, Chedorlaomer, and some allies with him, they came down into Canaan and basically warred against an alliance of kings in Canaan that had been revolting against those Mesopotamian kings. Well, in the process of that, in verse 14, chapter 14, verse 6, these are all the people that Chedorlaomer defeated along with these other kings, and the Horites in their Mount Seir were part of the people that these kings had defeated. So we see the Horites there. We see them defeated, not destroyed, because they continued to live. So we see them mentioned there, and then we see Jacob interacting with them as well. And then there's an interesting note over in Deuteronomy about the Horites that I think help us too in understanding their relationship with the descendants of Esau who became the Edomites. In Deuteronomy chapter 2, and let's actually start verse 20. Now, this is Moses recounting some history here. Verse 20, it is also regarded as the land of the Rephaim, for the Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites call them Zamzumim, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, just as he did for the sons of Esau, who lived in Seir. When he destroyed the Horites from before them, they dispossessed them and settled in their places even to this day. So it seems like the descendants of Esau moved into this land of Seir, and God helped those descendants of Esau largely displace the Horites from them. There was some intermarriage, as I mentioned, between Esau and Seir's granddaughter, Oholibamah, became one of Esau's wives. But we kind of see there some of the relationship and the connection then between the children of Israel, children of Jacob, and the Horites. And then just, thinking throughout the Old Testament, the Edomites and the Israelites, we continue to read about conflict between these two nations. Saul fought against them, David fought against them, Solomon fought against them, Jehoshaphat fought against the Edomites. So they factor significantly in the history of the nation of Israel. And then in terms of the prophets too, the prophet Obadiah, that was entirely written to the nation of Edom, really condemning them for, in fact, the way that they had mistreated the Israelites, who Obadiah makes the point is their own, they're their own kin. And yet they stood by and they watched and even gloated in the fact that the Israelites were being defeated by some of these other kings at that point in their history.
Hey, Greg?
Yeah.
This is Danny. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I've got a couple points. When you asked why the lineage of Esau may have been mentioned in that chapter, one thing I noticed was there was a note that kings had been kings had stood up in the Edomite people before kings of Israel came up. And if you recall back in Genesis chapter 17, in verse 6, I think it is, and then also in 16, God told Abraham that kings were going to come from him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very interesting point that may have been why the Holy Spirit revealed that, because I thought that's a fulfillment of what God told Abraham in 17 and 6. And then when you mentioned in Numbers how when the Israelites were coming up out of Egypt, the Edomites would allow them to pass through the way. I recall having studied that some time past, and if I recall correctly, God said, "You do not harm the Edomites, and you don't take one foot of property from them." And that goes to show that when God says he's going to give something to people or he's going to do something, he doesn't go back on his word. And so having read that before, it strengthened my faith to know that even though Esau was an outcast, God still blessed him because of his father. And he didn't take away from the land that he gave to them because he promised his father, who was righteous.
Yeah, he also said that about the Moabites and the Ammonites, because God says he told the Israelites, you know, don't harm the Moabites or the Ammonites, because I've given those lands to the descendants of Lot, who we read about earlier as well. Yeah, great point. So with that, a couple of minutes left. Any other points that people want to, you know, bring up from this text and from these accounts? You know, lessons that may be relevant to us, especially as we think about drawing near to God.
Greg, I think of the stark influence that Jacob must apparently had on his children for them to have deceived, as he was a deceiver.
Yeah.
And we certainly want to refrain from that and rearing our children to not be deceiving people. But if we're going to draw near to God, we need to have that sincere heart and not be deceitful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think about that sincere heart or that true heart in connection too with what we read about as far as them putting away all those foreign gods, right? And so I think part of having that true heart is putting away anything and everything that can distract us from God and from his will. And also I think, you know, obeying God's will all the way. I think we saw Jacob, you know, yeah, he left Paddan Aram. He started to head down into the land where God had wanted him to go, but he kind of took a detour and bought some land and, you know, maybe not all that temporary, because he bought land, built a house, built booths for his livestock in Shechem, which, you know, we don't read about God telling him to go there. We read about God telling Jacob to go to, you know, where his relatives were and the land of his birth. And so forth. And I think too, maybe to your point, Larry, that, you know, family relationships matter. We're reading a lot in here about these relationships between families, and we see some good things, we see some bad things, but I think one big takeaway is that family relationships do matter, and they have a significant impact on our lives and really ultimately on our relationship with God. And those are important relationships to maintain and strengthen. Any other thoughts?
Hey, Greg, Scott, one other interesting, when you say, why did God give us all this, you know, information here? And there's an interesting connection. You know, the only two people that, you know, left Egypt and went into the promised land, of course, were Joshua and Caleb. And Caleb was not a descendant of Jacob. He was a descendant of Esau, and you can trace that actually where we were in 36, in chapter 36 of Genesis, in verse 10 and 11. It talks about, you know, the sons of Esau, one being Eliphaz, and a son of Eliphaz being Kenaz, who is the name father of Kenazite, as best we know. And in Joshua chapter 14, it talks about Caleb was the son of Jephunneh the Kenazite.
Okay.
So yeah, that relationship is very interesting, in that one of the two that went into the promised land wasn't actually of the tribe of Israel.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'll have to look at that more, because when the 12 spies were selected, there was one from each of the tribes. So he would have been a member of one of those tribes. But that's an interesting observation. Appreciate that.
If there were ways for the tribes to adopt others.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing I can think of. And so, I don't know, it's very interesting to think of the implications of that.
Yeah. Also, Amalek is mentioned, and we know that the Israelites had a lot of dealings with the Amalekites as well. So Amalek was one of the descendants of Eliphaz as well, Esau's firstborn. So we see that name in verse 12 there, chapter 36. All right, well, I think we're at about time, unless anybody's got any final comments. All right, well, thank you all very much, and I'll see you in a few minutes.